Tech journalists. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for our paid six-month internships. Go to our website for details. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. The time is 4:59. Up next is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Old Gilbert Road Tavern Dinner, November 12th. The Old Gilbert Road Tavern Dinner is a benefit for the Rogue Farm Corps. They train and equip the next generation of farmers and ranchers through hands-on farm-based training programs and the preservation of Oregon's farmland. Again, that's the Old Gilbert Road Tavern Dinner, Sunday, November 12th. 6 to 9 p.m. at the Old Gilbert Road Tavern, 5501 Southeast 72nd Ave in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. After the Smoke Clears is the first in a series of educational public forums on the Eagle Creek Fire and learn how our community can support the recovery of the Columbia River Gorge. The series will feature a combination of multimedia presentations on what happened in the fire and examinations of key challenges moving forward, featuring insights from a collection of noted fire ecologists, forestry researchers, and leaders from local businesses, conservation, and recreation organizations. Again, that's After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, if you live in Oregon, you could lose a major tax deduction. A fight is brewing on Capitol Hill over that.
Hear the voices, stories, and struggles of the dreamers in Hillsboro.
And part two of our special report, Sex for Sale. Find out how it's happening right here at home.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 9th, 2017. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Tom Flynn. A hearing was set to take place this morning for Cliven Bundy, who took up arms against the federal government to demand that public land be privatized in Nevada. The Bundy trial was delayed, however, when the judge asked federal prosecutors to hand over any surveillance video they had taken outside the Bundy ranch during the 2014 standoff. Bundy and his two sons face 15 felony counts for the 2014 standoff. So far, officers have charged 19 people. Many of the same people, including Bundy's sons Ammon and Ryan, went on to be involved in the wildlife refuge takeover in Oregon in 2016.
The fight of the so-called dreamers to stay here in our country hits home. We've had a visiting journalist from Chile here at KBOO from the International Center for Journalists. At the Rock Creek campus of Portland Community College, Natalia Messer met with six people who explained their struggles to her.
Yo vine a los Estados Unidos cuando tenía 15 años y vine aquí no porque yo quería, pero
I came to the U.S. when I was 15 years old, and I came here not because I wanted it, but my parents had the idea of a better life here. When I arrived here, it was December, and it was very cold, and where I am from is more of a desert place, hotter, and I was in shock.
This is Liliana Luna, a young activist from Michoacán, Mexico. She is part of the 800,000 young undocumented immigrants called Dreamers, protected under the federal government program DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. DACA was created in 2012 under President Barack Obama's mandate to allow people brought into the U.S. illegally as children the legal protections they need to work and study in the United States, despite the immigration status of their parents. But a recent policy changes that scene since the Trump administration has announced the end of DACA.
Es muy cansado porque pensamos que ya teníamos, aunque sea algo que es DACA, donde nosotros pensábamos que iba a ser imposible que le quitaran esta protección a más de 700,000
It is very tiresome because we thought we already had something that is DACA. We thought it would be impossible to take away the protection of more than 700,000 people. And now with the new president, the situation has changed. And again, we feel attacked once more. When DACA was over and I could not apply again, everything was over for me. Actually, I do not have many options, and that's why it's very frustrating. And what do we do right now is ask the government to pass a law called the Dream Act. And what we do right now is ask the government to pass a law called the Dream Act.
The Dream Act is an American legislative proposal that would offer similar protections as DACA, but would first grant conditional residency and, upon meeting further qualifications, permanent residency. For now, Liliana Luna is leading a Dream effort to establish the first DACA resource center in the state of Oregon.
Estamos en un grupo llamado Oregon Dream Activist y somos personas que somos indocumentadas o tenemos DACA.
We are people who founded an organization called Oregon Dream Activists, and we are undocumented people or DACA recipients, and we are dedicated to promote action to apply practical pressure to the government to do fairer things as it should be. Here in Oregon, we will have a resource center for undocumented students, and it will be the first in all of the state of Oregon.
Liliana's struggle has not been easy. Like she tells us, Dreamers must fight every day with other problems like segregation, lack of opportunities, and racism.
Si eres un inmigrante de piel clara, aquí en los Estados Unidos te tratan muy diferente si eres un inmigrante de
If you are a light-skinned immigrant in the United States, they treat you very differently than if you are a dark-skinned immigrant. In fact, people who are not immigrants who have just been born here are treated very differently from light-skinned people. For me, the point of everything is the racism that is happening. And with the president who is in office right now, all these problems are being clearer than ever.
Petrona Dominguez, a DACA recipient from Guatemala, has faced episodes of racism, especially when she was 4 years old and she came for the first time to the U.S.
Cuando estaba chiquita, pues yo me fui con una escuela que es puro blancos. Y en esos tiempos yo nunca me puse a pensar, hasta ahorita que empecé...
When I was a little kid, I went to a school where most of the students were light-skinned. In those times, I have never thought about it before, but now I begin to reflect. What I have never noticed is that they wrote an article in the newspaper saying that my cousins and I were the first Hispanics ever in the school. At the time, I said how nice we were in the newspaper, but actually it was racist. Sometimes the other kids called me names. That made me laugh, but I never thought about the meaning of those names.
A veces me decían nombres. Que yo, pues dije, me podía reír, pero nunca me puse a pensar qué significaba esos nombres.
Now, with the end of DACA, Petrona is worried every day of what could happen to her and to her family.
A mí me encanta dormir por la razón de que yo no tengo que pensar en nada lo que está pasando. A veces sí salen los sueños de aquí para allá, pero yo sé.
I love to sleep because I do not have to think about anything that's happening right now. Sometimes nightmares appear in my dreams, but I know it is not real. I am afraid that something would happen to my little brothers who have been born and raised here.
Something similar is happening to Joanna Monroy, another DACA recipient from Mexico.
Mi nombre es Joanna Guadalupe Monroy Espinosa. Mis papás me trajeron aquí a los Estados Unidos cuando...
My name is Johanna Guadalupe Monroy Espinosa. My parents brought me to the United States when I was 5 years old. It was in 1997. My My dad was already in Oregon, and he decided to bring us to send us for because I think he missed our family, and there were more opportunities here than in Mexico. I crossed the border in a car, and then someone told me to pretend I was sleeping in the back of the car. Then, at the checkpoint, an officer looked at me and let us through.
Although Joanna is now married to an American citizen, she does not trust that this fact could help her.
No es tan fácil como uno pensamos. Inmigración no es nada más como una ley.
It is not as easy as you think. Immigration is not like a law. You could get an immigration agent who is very racist, and your case is over. Only one person could change everything. Sometimes they send you to Mexico, and sometimes to Arizona.
A veces te mandan a México, o a veces te mandan Arizona.
At Milenio, an organization that works with the Latino community and undocumented young people, Juan Rogel, its founder, believes in the need to create better public policies for immigrants.
Entonces es un diálogo que se tiene que hablar a nivel internacional. Es una crisis humanitaria, es como yo lo veo.
This is a dialogue that has to be discussed internationally. It is a humanitarian crisis. These families arrived due to a political treaty between three countries, Mexico, the United States, and Canada. The results were bad for Mexico and opened the doors to drug trafficking and an unintended wave of immigrants, which came to the U.S. in the 90s. These immigrants are DACA recipients. And now, how do we restore these generations that grew up believing that although they are not from here, although they may not have the documents, they are real Americans? For now, the situation remains uncertain, and the only hope for the Dreamers is not to keep quiet, but to keep raising their voices. I believe this struggle must be raised. The DACA recipients, the millennials, and youth have to come out to the streets and not be silent. We must go on with this struggle because one of the big mistakes about DACA in the past was that when it was approved, we all calmed down and we said we were given something. For KBOO Evening News, I am Sam Bowman, reading a story that was written and produced by Natalia Messer from Chile, who is visiting KBOO as a fellow from the International Center for Journalists.
Today, KBOO News presents the second in a 10-episode series on the business of sex in the Portland area. We'll be airing this series on Tuesdays and Thursdays for the next 3 weeks. Here's part two of Sex for Sale.
This is the second episode in KBOO's 10-part series on the sex industry in Portland. Each of the episodes will take on a different aspect of this subject.
This is an introduction. Here we'll give you a rough idea of the size of the industry, and we'll get input from the citizens of Portland about how they view the business of sex in our city. The third episode is about how the business fits in the history and culture of the city.
Episode 4 covers sex industry workers. Who are the people doing this work? How do they see it? And what about race, gender, and economic issues?
In 5, we focus on law and enforcement. We'll talk with the FBI, Department of Justice, and the Portland Police Bureau about what they're doing on a day-to-day basis.
Episode 6 is about sex trafficking, the exploitation of children in the sex industry, and the forced employment of adults.
The 7th episode focuses on prostitution, what it means in Portland, how we regulate it, and the issues that it raises.
8th episode looks at sex stores and porn here in Portland.
Episode 9 looks at stripping, burlesque, and other ways to get naked in this city, and how that fits in our culture.
And in the end, episode 10, we'll try to bring together some closing thoughts. We'll challenge your thinking, whatever it is.
Just for setting a context, we asked Officer Chris Lindsay and Undercover Agent A of the Portland Police Bureau, do you think that Portland is a hub of the sex industry?
I would say yes to an extent because, I think at least as recently as either 2015 or 2016, Portland per capita had the most strip clubs in the nation. And when you think of the sex industry, don't think of them as standalone kind of entities. There's some overlap. And you will have, whether you want to call them sex workers or prostitutes or escorts or victims or survivors of sex trafficking, will work within multiple aspects of the sex industry. Yeah, we do have people being trafficked out side of strip clubs. Portland is also, it's kind of a geographical hub. It's right on I-5. There's a lot of industry here. It's got the number one airport, and well, it was number one airport in the nation. You have a lot of truck drivers along I-84 and I-5. When you have that kind of influx of the, you have a lot of, you know, lingerie shops and...
Here's FBI agent Denise Bean putting the local culture into a broader perspective.
I think there's some characteristics about Portland specifically that do enable traffickers to ply their trade with much success here. And you see that in strip clubs and adult sex shops, et cetera. I don't think the adult sex shops are so much of a causality as I do think the strip clubs are, because, you know, one of the things that we know about sex trafficking is the normalization of sexual exploitation tends to increase its proliferation. So if the community accepts sexual exploitation as the norm, then that's a area where you may find an increased occurrence of sex trafficking.
Wait a minute. Did you say we accept exploitation as a norm?
If a community does, it's the community factors. I didn't say that we did, but I said if a community accepts sexual exploitation as kind of a norm, and it depends on what your beliefs are with respect to strip clubs, right? You know, we
right.
have strip clubs that allow an 18-year-old to dance in front of adults, and an 18-year-old is an adult. But, you know, at what point does the normalization of that sexual activity, being dancing naked, at what point does that maybe turn the corner to something that's more participatory?
So there's sort of a cultural acceptance of certain kinds of actions.
Right.
By the way, we think that Agent Bean was right in talking about normalization. Isn't this where the business of sex has an interesting connection with the exploitation of women in general? Or are we reaching too far to think that?
But in this episode, we want to give most of our time to the people of Portland. What do they think about these issues? Let's get back to the voice of the people.
I am not the expert in this, so I could not speak to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not speak to that.
This is tricky because I don't really know. Sorry, as a woman, I've never utilized the sex industry.
I don't know a lot about it. I'm not sure.
I remember who quotes it, but they say that, you know, it's a comedian, and I think he's saying, well, what isn't, what do we not use sex to sell, I guess, you know? So, in terms of that, you know, is a Nike ad, or is it uses sex to sell a commodity?
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know. But I think about it just in terms of pornography or prostitution.
Anything in the world is safer when it's open and communicated.
Mm-hmm.
Hiding things and keeping it on the dark makes people do... I've watched people shoot up. Instead of being able to get clean needles, which they are able to around here, which is nice, but I've seen people do stuff, put juice in their arm, mix it, you know, things like that, because they want that. And so when things are available, even like drugs or sexual activities, then people don't commit gluttony with it.
Mm-hmm.
They ration it out and things like that and respect it more when there's a balance. So that's where regulation can start, actually addressing the fact that people have sex.
People who are desperate are going to go where the money is, and you cannot blame them for that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And do you think there's anything we could do to regulate it differently, or in this case, regulate it at all?
I think regulating the men who support it, but in general, as you look at the last 10 years, pornography has exponentially grown. And as one of Jehovah's Witnesses, because it is what the Bible foretells, like, it would get so bad, and it affects family life, and, you know, it's a part of a bigger problem. But I don't believe that there's any solution for it except for the Creator to step in. So,
prostitution should be legal, because if you have an adult grown woman who makes a conscious choice to say, I'm willing to do this and I'm comfortable doing this and nobody coerced me into doing this, why should I not be able to be compensated for my time in the same way that I can cook my own dinner, but if I go to a restaurant and somebody cooks it for me, I'm going to enjoy it more, I'm going to feel better about it, and I am happy to pay what I need for it. And I can only assume, as a guy, if I can give myself a hand job, but I can find a woman who is willing to give me one, and I am happy to pay her for one, and I will enjoy it more, why is that not okay? In the same way I can try to scratch my own back, or I can go to a massage therapist.
Talk a little more about Portland's history and culture.
We'd like your feedback. At the end of this series, we'll do a full episode in which you get to speak your mind on this subject. Call the KBOO Newsroom at 503-231-8187, and we'll hear you out and put you on the air. Again, the number is 503-231-8187.
KBOO News, this has been Tom Flynn. Natalie Motti co-anchored, and Grace Ann Smith did those interviews on the street. Thanks for listening. Again, you can hear the rest of the 10-part series on KBOO on Tuesdays and Thursdays over the next 3 weeks, and call us with your comments.
Oregon wildlife leaders are trying to get permission to remove and kill California sea lions at Willamette Falls. Officials say the animals are threatening endangered fish that swim through the falls. Bruce McIntosh is the deputy fish chief of inland fisheries of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and he says this year sea lions ate about a quarter of the wild steelhead that were waiting to go up the fish ladder. He calls it a crisis situation. He also says the number of sea lions at the falls has grown from just a few animals to more than 40 during the past year. Throughout history, sea lions have fished Willamette Falls and into the Columbia, though mostly they are associated with living in the ocean habitat.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report by Sean Stewart on the new documentary, The Art of the Protest Song. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather: overcast with some rain showers and thunder possible, a low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow, more of the same, a high of 51 and about a quarter of an inch of rain. Today in history, on November 9th, 1938, the Nazis launched a campaign of terror against Jewish people in Austria and Germany. The violence came to be called Kristallnacht, or Night of Broken Glass, because of countless smashed windows. The violence killed 100 Jews and damaged thousands of businesses. The event foreshadowed the Holocaust. The quote of the day is from Albert Einstein, who said, "The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it."
Senate Republicans are parting with the president and their efforts to change the U.S. tax code. They offered a plan today that would delay the corporate tax cut President Trump has demanded and blow up House Republicans' compromise on a controversial deduction. GOP Senate leaders unveiled a tax package that would delay cutting the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20% until 2019. The Washington Post reports that's a big difference from Trump's idea of immediate tax cuts that he says are necessary to spur the economy. The one-year delay would lower the cost of the Senate bill by more than $100 billion. And in a move that could cause major tensions in the House, the Senate bill would also no longer allow Americans to deduct state and local taxes from their federal bills, a change that could raise taxes overall for Americans, especially in high-tax states like Oregon and California.
In Washington State this week, Jenny Durkin was elected to become Seattle's first openly lesbian mayor and the Emerald City's first female mayor since the 1920s. Durkin, a former federal prosecutor, defeated fellow female Democrat Carrie Moon in the nonpartisan mayoral race. The women were vying for the job of former Seattle Mayor Ed Murray. He's a gay man who resigned in September after five men accused him of sexual abuse. Murray has denied their accusations.
In today's report from National Native News, people return home to their First Nation reserve after being away for years, and tribal leaders want federal help on health care and other issues.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Members of a First Nation in Manitoba have returned to their homes on a reserve after years away. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the reserve at Lake St. Martin was ravaged in 2011.
The return home is being described as a trickle. Dozens of families have been coming home after the houses in their community were destroyed by heavy spring floods more than 6 years ago. The reserve housed 1,400 people. During the past 6 years, many stayed in hotels or in short-term rental units in the city of Winnipeg and other communities. The cost of their temporary housing reached more than $160 million. Now many have the keys to their new homes and celebrated their return. But some of the celebrations are muted because of the human cost of the displacement. More than 100 band members have died over the past few years, some from suicide. And some, like band member and university researcher Merle Ballard, are still looking for answers, such as why it took 6 years to rebuild the community.
This is the 21st century, and you know, this is still happening. People are being displaced. They're being sacrificed for the non-Indigenous people.
The first phase of the recent rebuilding of 190 new homes will be completed by the end of January, and the government says it's committed to completing the work to get all those who were displaced home. Meanwhile, Lake St. Martin is still waiting for part of a $90 million settlement they and other First Nations filed against the federal and provincial governments. They claim that the province of Manitoba caused the flooding knowingly and recklessly by pushing excessive amounts of floodwater into Lake Manitoba. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
An Indian Health Service representative says the agency is working to address issues at the Pine Ridge Hospital in South Dakota, which will lose its Medicaid funding this month. Elizabeth Fowler with IHS told the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs Wednesday, right now there are no direct actions to halt the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services from terminating its agreement. She says the IHS is considering next steps to address staffing levels and other urgent issues. The hospital received notice about the funding cut last week following a recent survey. Tribal leaders in the Great Plains region say they support proposed legislation for an assessment of health care nationwide at Indian Health Service hospitals. Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate Chairman Dave Flute told the committee tribes need to be consulted.
The accountability and transparency that we're looking for is, and it all goes back to consultation and just good communication with the tribes. Tribes are trying to help figure out what is going on in all areas. And I apologize to you, Mr. Chairman, that there is, in my opinion, there is no one that is greater than the other. It all has to do with quality of service. And we're just not getting the answers. Consultation is not there. We try to reach out and communicate, and we just don't get the answers that we're looking for.
Earlier this year, the independent outside audit of the Indian Health Service Act was introduced. Currently, there is no House companion bill. The Indian Affairs Committee Wednesday also heard testimony on the STOP Act, which would prohibit the export of sacred items and increase penalties for stealing and trafficking items. Governor Curt Riley from Acoma Pueblo told the committee tribal people are the knowledge keepers who know the difference between art and sacred items.
Who is the cultural expert here? Whenever you ask that, it is the individual Pueblos, tribes, and nations who are experts of their own culture. rather than someone else who has studied our culture. They are not experts.
The Pueblo has been working with various governments to get a sacred item returned home from overseas. Riley says having the backing of federal law would help tribes in their repatriation efforts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation.
Does it make you safer? Or is it just creepy that online companies can see more of what you're doing? It's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Would you give your house key to a complete stranger, letting that person, whose name you don't even know, walk right into your home when you're not there? One stranger who's brazenly asking you and millions of other people to do just that is Jeff Bezos. He's head honcho of Amazon, the e-commerce behemoth whose vast supercomputer network routinely compiles and stores dossiers on every one of his customers. He's obsessed with having the most data on the most people. It's a little creepy. Now, adding to the creep factor, Jeff literally wants Amazon to get inside your home. And ironically, he's using security as his rationale. Rather than simply delivering the products you order from Amazon to your doorstep, the corporation wants a key to unlock your door, allowing its delivery crews to go inside and do you the favor of placing the packages securely in your abode. What could possibly go wrong with that? Other than you being robbed, of course, either by rogue Amazon employees or by hackers, who will certainly gain access to the corporation's computerized key codes. Or maybe Crusher, your pit bull, mauls the Amazon intruder and you get sued. Need I mention that Bezos expects you to pay for the privilege of having his employees enter your home? First, his dicey Open Sesame program, which he calls Amazon Key, is available only to customers who shell out $99 a year to be Amazon Prime members. Second, you must buy a special internet unlocking gizmo and a particular camera to join his corporate key club. And guess where you must go to buy this entry technology? Yes, Amazon, where prices for the gizmo and camera setup start at $250. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a deal! For Amazon, that is. Bezos' real goal is not to get inside your home, but inside your wallet.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now it's time for Climate Connections. This is an all-encompassing daily report that aims to show how climate change is affecting all of our daily lives.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At raw bars across the country, you can slurp salty oysters off their shells. But climate change could make this raw delicacy more dangerous to eat. The risk comes from Vibrio parahemolyticus and Vibrio vulnificus, pathogens that are as villainous as they sound. Found in seawater, they can build up in shellfish and make people sick. Most illnesses occur during the warm months of the year, from May to October. One reason for the increased risk is that Vibrios reproduce rapidly when it's warm.
The bacteria become very abundant.
That's Rita Caldwell of the University of Maryland, College Park. She says the way Vibrios respond to seasonal temperatures prompted her to study how they're affected by climate change. She and her team looked at roughly 50 years of data.
And we found that with the ocean warming, the numbers of Vibrios increase.
And so do human diseases caused by these pathogens. Cooking oysters is the best way to avoid getting sick. But no matter how you eat your oysters, the research provides an important pearl of knowledge. Climate change has consequences for human health. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now a look at today's date in labor history.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1952. That was the day that the labor movement lost Philip Murray. Philip was born in Scotland in 1886 to an Irish Catholic family. His father was a coal miner and a union leader. Philip followed his father into the mines at just the age of 10 years old. The father and son made the trip to the Pennsylvania coal fields together when Philip was just 16. They saved enough money and then sent for the rest of their family. One day, Philip got into an altercation with one of his bosses. Not only was he fired, his entire family was kicked out of their company home. From that point on, Philip was dedicated to the union cause as the only hope for working people. He quickly rose through the ranks of the United Mine Workers, becoming vice president by the time he was 33. He worked closely with United Mine Workers president John L. Lewis. During the 1930s, there became a nationwide drive to organize industrial workers. Philip was appointed to lead the Steelworkers Organizing Committee, a key sector for the industrial effort. The Steelworker campaign met with historic success. They reached a collective bargaining agreement with U.S. Steel, the giant of the industry. Philip went on to become the first president of the United Steelworkers of America, as well as president of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. Under his leadership, industrial labor became a powerful force. But that force was checked by the passage of the Anti-Union Taft-Hartley Act in 1947. The anti-communist hysteria of the Red Scare also took its toll on the CIO, forcing Philip to expel some of the most radical unions from the organization. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The New Jersey AFL-CIO says the election of Phil Murphy as governor and Sheila Oliver as lieutenant governor speaks to the unmatched mobilization efforts of organized labor and the New Jersey AFL-CIO's political program that is unparalleled by any other in our state or nation. AFL-CIO in New Jersey says that effort included thousands of union volunteers, national, state, and local affiliates, central labor councils, and building trades councils. Phone banks were activated and thousands of mail pieces delivered statewide. In addition to the governor and lieutenant governor, labor in New Jersey also expanded pro-labor majorities in the state legislature. 43 rank-and-file union members running for public office won their elections. New Jersey's AFL-CIO says working people needed a victory and organized labor delivered. Republicans in the Wisconsin State Senate have made it the 28th state to call for a new U.S. Constitutional Convention. It takes 34 states to actually call a convention to rewrite America's Constitution. The resolution 28 states have now passed says that the purpose of the Constitutional Convention shall be, quote, for the limited purpose of requiring the federal government to operate under a balanced budget. But once the Constitutional Convention Pandora's box is open, it could well turn into a runaway convention where other constitutional rewrites could happen. And since it's driven by state legislatures controlled by Republicans, America could wake up one day to a new U.S. Constitution written essentially by Republicans. Just 14 states had legislatures totally controlled by Republicans in 2009. In 2017, there are 33 such states. In 2010, the GOP was able to gerrymander congressional districts, cementing the Republican state-level political power and protecting its congressional seats. The constitutionality of that gerrymandering is being decided in a case from Wisconsin currently before the U.S. Supreme Court. The Pension Benefits Guarantee Corporation, PBGC, has reached a new agreement with Sears that will put $500 million into two Sears pension plans that have approximately 100,000 people in them. The deal frees the struggling Sears from having to protect subsidiaries holding real estate and intellectual property for the benefit of those pension plans. The deal is expected to take a few months to close, and when it does, Sears will be free to sell off more of its assets. Sears has been losing billions of dollars in recent years. WIN is America's multimedia news voice for workers.
We need to make more money. You know, what they're paying us, the greedy corporations, they just want to pay us what they want to pay us. And it's not right.
We are sick of an economy and a democracy that are rigged against us.
Support WIN's worker news mission at workersindependentnews.com.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
In Puerto Rico, communities continue to be devastated by the effects of Hurricane Maria more than 1 month ago. Some areas have taken it upon themselves to clean out the trash and debris and get their schools back open. But a major concern in the U.S. Commonwealth is that private corporations from the mainland U.S. will take over the schools and privatize them into corporate charter schools. According to a report in The Intercept, these fears are not unfounded. In New Orleans, after Hurricane Katrina, many of the damaged schools were privatized and public housing projects were demolished to make way for developers. The Cooper Housing Project, for example, which was not damaged during the storm, was demolished and a high-profile Trump Towers was put in its place.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at this number, 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman, Tom Flynn, Natalia Messer. The producer is myself, Annette Newell. Our engineer is Ben Shiregi. Sam Bowman is filling in as the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director for Zelos Ellis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Tom. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Linda Olsen Osterlund talks to journalist, writer, and creator of alternative radio, David Barsamian, ahead of his appearance at Portland's Clinton Street Theater on Sunday. At 9, Beloved Community addresses the spiritual foundations of nonviolence, activism, and peace building. At 10 on Valley News, personal tales of how black women who look nothing alike are often mistaken for each other by their white neighbors. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's The Digital Divide, analyzing how to use science, medicine, and technology to benefit society and keep them from harming us. KBOO is your independent source for news and entertainment. Become a member. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Tonight, KBOO's Sean Stewart interviews Bill Valenti about an upcoming event called The Art of the Protest Song.
This is Sean Stewart, and I'm speaking with William L. Valenti, better known as Bill. He is a Bend, Oregon-based singer-songwriter, a protest song historian, and he also has an online journalism project called Rantcaster. For 3 years in a row, he has a series called The Art of the Protest Song. This year, it's running in conjunction with the closing date of High Hopes, the Journey of John F. Kennedy exhibit. And this is next Sunday?
Next Sunday, November 12th, at the Oregon Historical Society in downtown Portland, starting at 2 p.m. Yeah, 2 p.m. to 3:30.
Could you give us some details about the event?
The event, actually, the tail end, it's the last day of this, I think, 4 or 5 months running exhibit on JFK. Eliza Canty Jones, who's the program director there, gotten to know her and mentioned her several times our Art of the Protest Song series, and she thought it would be interesting to bring that to the conclusion of the JFK exhibit, especially including some protest songs from the Kennedy era, which is what we're planning to do.
So this is the third year in a row that you're doing this. Could you tell us about how the project came into fruition?
It kind of started, I have focused a lot of my songwriting efforts on sort of rejuvenating the art of the protest song. I grew up, came of age in the 60s listening to and covering protest songs from the like of Pete Seeger and Phil Oakes and Bob Dylan and all the denizens of the 1960s protest songwriting scenario. And when I started doing performances, when I started writing songs, actually about 8 or 9 years ago when I moved to Bend, I included a lot of my own protest songs in my set list, and I began to hear from audience members that they really enjoyed hearing the kind of music that they just don't hear anymore on the radio. It doesn't get radio play. You don't hear it at the big folk festivals. And really the only place where you hear original protest songs is in news and events like the Art of the Protest. So hearing that kind of feedback from the audiences led me to put together this idea called the Art of the Protest Song, which I consider to be kind of an edutainment event in that it includes classic protest songs from throughout U.S. history, civil rights movement, labor movement, environmental movement, etc., classic protest songs known by just about everyone, and contemporary original work on contemporary topics. And the idea being that I consider the protest song to be a unique genre in the musical space, as much, I would argue, as a form of journalism as it is a form of music. We put together our first Art of the Protest Song show. It was really more than 3 years ago. It was during the Occupy Wall Street movement, which is, I think, about 5 years old now, maybe 4 or 5 years old. I'm kind of lost track of that. And we did one at the Tower Theater here in Bend, which was kind of fun because we kitted out the stage to look like an Occupy site with tents and burn barrels and debris and signs and all that kind of stuff. And it was a lot of fun. So we took that idea on the road, not with the same performers, but it's actually, I'm the common ingredient in all of these shows. And we've done 17 shows now around the country in the last 3.5 to 4 years, I guess. Focused mainly on the West Coast, but we've done a couple of shows in New Jersey and have invitations to do shows in a number of other places in between. So that's kind of the history of it. And the audience reaction to all of these shows has been overwhelmingly positive. Again, a lot of people coming up afterwards and saying we don't get to hear this kind of music on the radio or in any of the familiar venues anymore. So it's nice to have a reprise of great classic protest songs from our past and to hear well-crafted original work that's addressing topics of current interest.
You have three other performers besides yourself, Alexa Wiley, Magdalena, and Nathan Earle.
Yes.
Could you give us a little background on those folks?
All three of them are very experienced songwriters in their own right. And I actually have not met Nathan, but I'm looking forward to it. But Magdalena and Alexa Wiley. Alexa is a Portland-based songwriter, and I performed with her in a couple of Art of the Protest Song events, one in Portland a few years ago at Artichoke Music, and the most recent one here in Bend that I think it's about 3 or 4 months ago. And Magda is a songwriter that I met actually at one of Matt Beard's songwriting workshops, and she has a terrific repertoire of feminist protest songs, I would say. And Nathan also has quite a repertoire of protest songs in his portfolio, and so I think the combination of two guys, two women, focusing on both classic protest songs and contemporary stuff is what makes the idea very interesting. So each of us will do covers from the Kennedy era. That's the sort of the basic idea, and then each of us will also do two or three of our own original works.
In an age that we are currently living in, with the political climate and the strife and all that we've been experiencing with, racial injustice and, violence, what can you tell us why the protest song is as relevant, if not more relevant, than it's ever been?
Well, I would make the argument that the protest song and spoken word poetry, really, I consider to be sort of in the same category, have for virtually all of human civilization been a very form of communication, a powerful form of op-ed commentary, and in fact have been, for most of civilization, the vector by which people got their news and their opinion and their commentary. It was troubadours and bards and minstrels and goliards and all these other terms used to describe people who wandered around the landscape bringing people their news in the form of songs and spoken word poetry. And it's not that that has died out, it's just that it hasn't really, I don't think, has not been integrated very well into the current source of news, which is the web medium. And a lot of what I'm doing in this idea called Rantcaster is related to the reintegration of the protest song into the print media. But I think that it has always been such a powerful form of communication. And obviously the things that are going on around us right now just cry out for more protest songs on what's going on around us. So my humble goal is to get more and more songwriters focused on writing songs, topical songs, protest songs, and performing them, whether in small venues or large venues or on radio stations or whatever, in order to bring the genre back to life. I think it has gone a little bit dormant in the last 20 or 30 years, in large part because it doesn't get radio play, as I mentioned earlier.
Do you have a community or a group that you have assembled that is looking to try to reconvene community of people that are looking to write songs about social justice issues?
Yes. I mean, the more I do these events, the more I discover artists who are interested in presenting some of their work, some of their protest songs, or in learning more about it. I mean, I had a conversation last year, I guess maybe 18 months ago, in Corvallis, Oregon, with a guy who's got a long association with the Grammy Museum and the Grammy organization, and he was really excited about the idea in that it presented a platform for up-and-coming songwriters to focus on, to find a venue, to find an outlet for their work on topical songs. And I truly believe that that is one of the goals, well, certainly it is one of my goals, is to make venues available for songwriters who have an inclination to write protest songs, to find venues where they can perform them. I think under this banner of the art of the protest song, I think we make a convincing argument that the protest song is a distinct genre of music, in that it has this, I would argue, a very powerful journalistic component to it.
Where can our listeners find out more about you and your music and your various projects?
Well, I'm kind of an unusual songwriter. I've written hundreds of songs in the last 8 or 9 years since I started writing. And by the way, I'm going to be 69 years old in a week or so. And I cut my teeth on protest songs during the heyday, the golden age of protest songwriting and performing in the 60s. So I'm not a spring chicken, and I kind of describe myself, humorously, as a submerging artist. But what I've done, I don't have a CD. I haven't produced a CD. I do all my stuff is just live, and it keeps me honest, keeps me going. But one of the things I've discovered is a good example. A couple of years, 4 years ago, I guess it was, when the uprising, the Arab, so-called Arab Spring uprising in Cairo and a number of other places in North Africa, I wrote a song called "Rise Up," and I wrote the song, I recorded it, I created a little slideshow, and I posted it on YouTube and started posting links to the song with news articles from CNN, from BBC, from all these other news organizations about that topic. And I found that the song became immediately associated with the news, and therefore got many thousands of downloads in just a few days, because it was topical, current, punchy, and because I associated it with the news, it became almost like a little bit of op-ed journalism on the side. And I've been doing a lot of that since that initial experience with the Arab Spring uprising. And I've encouraged other songwriters that I've come to know to do the same thing, to listen to what's going on in the news, try to synthesize it into a 2.5 or 3 or 3.5 minute song, and present it to the world as in association happening in the news. I think that's a really powerful way to present this music. And so I've been doing a lot of that, and I intend to continue to do more of it and to encourage other songwriters to do the same.
Do you have any other events coming up?
We are working on an Art of the Protest song in Seattle sometime in January. I don't have any exact dates or even the venue yet, but I'm working on it. And we have an invitation to do an Art of the Protest song show at the Woody Guthrie Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma in February. And I'm really excited about that one because obviously Woody Guthrie is considered to be an icon in the protest song writer community. And it would be kind of fun to go there and do this kind of presentation. We also like to do one at the Grammy Museum in Los Angeles, again, for the reasons I mentioned earlier. I think there's a great opportunity to instill the art, the craft of writing protest songs in a bunch of up-and-coming songwriters. I've also done a couple of workshops on protest songwriting, one at the most recently at the Tumbleweed Festival in Washington in September. So, yeah, I mean, the plan going down the road is I've gotten to know a lot of other songwriters. I've started talking to a pretty broad network of songwriters around the country and even outside the country about staging Art of the Protest song events in their communities where a local advocate or protagonist books a venue, recruits two or three other songwriters, and I show up as the MC and pull the thing together, and we take the show on the road. So each show has a different group of individuals involved. I'm kind of the common denominator, but the idea is to get local singer-songwriters involved in promoting a show and then go on to the next venue.
So you're planting seeds.
Yeah, I think, let's call me the Johnny Appleseed of protest songwriters. And I kind of consider it to be my mission to get other songwriters interested in doing this. And there's always been, in fact, I kind of bristle every time I hear somebody say this, that, you know, people, particularly folk songwriters and pop songwriters, are very afraid of writing stuff and performing stuff that might offend certain members of the audience. I certainly appreciate that, especially for someone who's making a living doing gigs and making records. But in general, for people like me who aren't professional singer-songwriters but are, you know, passionate about the idea, I think it's just complete baloney. That if you have something to say and you can craft it into a clever, well-written 3 or 3.5 minute song, there's nothing more powerful than that. I always say that the pen is mightier than the sword, but a song is mightier still. And I get great feedback on that slogan from the people that to whom I mention it in our performances, and I think they're generally in agreement that they want to hear more songs like this.
Bill, thank you so much. That was fantastic. I appreciate the time you took with us to talk about the event and the future of the Art of the Protest song.
Well, thank you very much, Sean, for the opportunity, and I hope lots of folks come out to the Oregon Historical Society next Sunday, November 12th, and you'll hear some really good stuff from the Kennedy era and some really good stuff from what's going on around us today. Of cowards on the right. So off them all these neocons who never joined the fight. Reveal for all the feckless gall of cowards on the right. Whose flag great bluster can't conceal the stripe of yellow hue that separates false patriots from heroes true and blue. I can hear the chants of toadies leading cheers for victory as the chicken hawks now scheme to shift responsibility. But wiser men hold history's pen, this story's ours to tell. The neocons will soon be gone, and we do not wish them well.
So off them all these neocons who never join the fight. Reveal for all the feckless gall of cowards on the right. Whose flag draped bluster can't conceal the stripe of yellow hue that separates false patriots from heroes true and blue.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Holds open meetings.